the pursuit of happiness just seems a bore.
We're going to be speaking with Alan Castles, who's a drug policy researcher at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's recently written the book Selling Sickness along with Ray Moynihan, and it is concerning how the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies are turning us all into patients. Welcome on our show today, Alan.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for being on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is... an issue that is something I've followed personally for many years, back to when they were trying to turn female sexual dysfunction into a disease, as well as the premenstrual disorders into diseases. And I've always been curious about the way in which they're creating diseases for us to be able to fill the market. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should mention premenstrual syndrome and that kind of thing. I mean, the whole concept of selling sickness really has grown quite enormously in the last decade, but we've seen examples of it from, 20, 30 years ago when they were essentially taking normal rites of passage for women, what we would call the menopause, and turning that into a condition known as estrogen deficiency in order to sell, a whole generation of women to the concept that they need to be medicating menopause. And even 40 years ago when this was starting, there were the same sort of telltale signs that we see today, the use of celebrities to push certain conceptions of illness, the use of expert spokespeople. So these would be, prominent doctors who would go around and lecture other physicians about why they need to be treating things in a certain way. And, it's just something that that we have documented in our book all the way from menopause through, which I think, to the latest example, when, as you mentioned, female sexual dysfunction, where, Ray and I have witnessed the creation of basically a new market for female sexual dysfunction. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has been very happy with the success of drugs like Viagra, but have also asked the question, why can't we be producing something for women? And so for the last 5 years, we've seen large companies eager to cash in on female sexual dysfunction, basically underwriting conferences and meetings and employing researchers to redefine what's normal in terms of female sexuality, in order that at the end of the day there might be a patentable product that they can sell to people.
Well, let's just let our listeners know that this is a $500 billion a year industry, which is really tremendous, and it's really transformed how we look at ourselves. We think about physical health and mental well-being from childhood to old age. I think one of the things that you mentioned in the book that was pretty remarkable is that, I don't know what year this was stated, but the head of Merck wrote in Fortune magazine about his dream of hoping to sell to healthy people and to everyone to be able to make them a market for his drugs.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he was quoted in Fortune magazine in 1976 saying that he wanted his company, Merck, which is one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, to be more like Wrigley's, the chewing gum maker, because he, quote, wanted to sell to everyone, including, and he said that he was disappointed that his company was limited to producing sick people products and that he wanted to be able to produce drugs for healthy people.
Well, clearly his dream is realized. I think that when you look at the statistics that we are less than 5% of the world's population, but we're taking 50% of the globe's drugs, that we're extraordinarily over-medicated.
That's right. Some would say vastly over-medicated. Certainly when you start comparing how we deal with health problems in the U.S. to other industrialized countries, and, the one unique feature of the United States is the rampant use of direct-to-consumer advertising, and this would be the advertisements on TV and radio and in magazines you know, telling people to, you know, get yourself, get tested, you may be at risk, and the typical punchline is to see your doctor, because, of course, your doctor is the only person who can prescribe something. That kind of in-your-face marketing, which has really grown enormously in the last 10 years, has really, I think, kind of ramped up this kind of selling of sickness. Americans now, on average, watch 10 drug advertisements per day. The industry spends upwards of $4 billion a year to convince you that you may be sick and you need some kind of treatment. So it really is astonishing. The reason I say the U.S. is unique in this is that there's only two countries in the world that allow this kind of advertising, and that's the United States and New Zealand.
Right, then I was right. I think I read that in Adbusters, actually. But maybe it was something you had written in Adbusters. But I think that's extraordinary that we are being fed these particular advertisements for prescription drugs, while the rest of the world has clearly made a statement that they don't want to be fed those kinds of ads.
And part of it has to do with the fact that the U.S. Has very strong protections of freedom of speech, and including commercial freedom of speech. But at the same time, I think everyone hopes that their physician is making choices about which drug he or she's going to prescribe on the basis of the best evidence, not on the basis of who was able to make the most convincing marketing plea.
Right. I think we could, just looking at the statistic that the amount that we're spending has risen 100% in 6 years. And talk to us about what are the most popular. Are they antidepressants and heart medicine? Is that...
You mean in terms of contributing to the rise? Yeah, I mean...
What is it that we're taking all these drugs? What are the most popular ones that kind of are the ones a lot of people are on?
Well, the antidepressants are certainly have been vastly. It's just an enormous market now, where even mild, moderate symptoms of depression are being automatically treated with very powerful drugs, Prozac-like drugs. Drugs like Paxil and Zoloft and so on. And the prescribing of those has grown enormously, which, at one level you might say, well, what's wrong with this? Maybe doctors are better able to diagnose depression and hence are able to treat people. I would argue that the part of the problem is that the alternatives to pharmaceuticals, and these would be things like talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that, which are really effective and have good evidence as to their effectiveness, those aren't marketed in the same way that the drugs are. You can't patent talk therapy. So, the unfortunate thing about this huge rise in the use of these kinds of drugs is that the alternatives aren't being used, and those alternatives may be more effective for a lot of people.
And to me, it's horrific that we've been targeting so many teenagers. I think the statistics were that kids who are under 18 were accounted for. Let's see, how many millions were they taking? I think it was here that
yeah.
2 million. Let's see. 10 million prescriptions are written for kids who are under 18 years old.
Right, what a lot of people won't know is that there is actually emerging evidence that suggests that prescribing antidepressants to a teenager may do more harm than good. So you might actually be increasing the rates of suicidal behavior by prescribing antidepressants to teenagers. The whole over-marketing and the over-prescribing of drugs can really have a kind of downside, a serious downside to a lot of ways that the drugs are being used.
Well, it seems that if the information about a placebo, even in the best of studies, has shown to be as effective as the antidepressant drugs, that it's almost criminal to think about giving these kinds of drugs that can play havoc with their emotional state to the point of suicide, that there would be more criminal investigations into some of this.
Yeah. Well, as you know, there are quite a few lawsuits and quite a bit of litigation underway against companies who have been concealing data on the use of their drugs in children. And at the same time, physicians who face patients who young kids who are very difficulty coping and that kind of thing, maybe in very dire circumstances, these drugs will have some benefit and some effect. The problem, of course, though, is that if you're a drug company marketing drugs, you don't want to limit your market just to people on the very extreme end. You want to push it lower and lower so that even people with moderate or even low a low level of depression would be receiving these kinds of drugs. And that's when you get into problems, when you're essentially treating largely healthy people.
And I'll let the listeners know I'm speaking with Alan Castells. Is that how you say your last name?
It's Castles.
Castles, who is the co-author of a book entitled Selling Sickness. It's how the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies are turning us all into patients. It's an excellent read. It reads kind of like a mystery novel to me, going through all these different cases. I found it really entertaining, and hope that more people will pick this book up. It's, just the information about how they were treating the post-menstrual disorder, and that they essentially marketed Prozac by turning it into Seraphim.
I mean, that's a really interesting anecdote where, Prozac was at the end of its patent life. So the company was able to essentially test the drug to treat women with extreme PMS, and hence arose this condition called premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So when you medicalize PMS this way, you can produce a drug to treat it. And what they did is they changed the color of the pill and they changed the name. But it's the same antidepressant now being promoted and used in women who have extreme PMS. Now, this is a condition, by the way, that I'm not trying to downplay the fact that some women may have very extreme menstrual cycles, and something like this might help some of them. Though, when you look at how other countries have dealt with this, PMDD is not even considered to be a condition in Europe. So the drug Seraphim doesn't sell there. it's interesting when you start crossing borders and you look at how other countries deal with medical conditions. It sort of gives you a certain insight into perhaps us medicalizing far too much.
Well, I know that they've done studies, and this is not a study that you hear about at all here in the United States. I found it, and it was a really small little story kind of buried somewhere, and I can't even find my citation for it, but maybe you could shed some light on this. According to global studies, that individuals with schizophrenia tend to be affected as youths and young adults, and that by the time they hit their mid to late 30s, the problems, the effects of schizophrenic behavior somewhat dissipate or at sometimes disappear entirely, and that only in the United States are individuals who are diagnosed with schizophrenia end up with it as a lifetime disease. Have you heard about that?
No, I haven't really heard of that specifically. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean,
because we medicate so heavily, and the medications.
Certainly the forces behind the real marketing of some of those very powerful antipsychotic drugs. What I do know is that those drugs, and these would be sort of what they call the atypical antipsychotic drugs, like Zyprexa and so on.
Those are the anti-anxiety drugs.
Well, they're being used as anti-anxiety drugs. Mm-hmm. They're being used as drugs to sedate people, largely people living in old, in seniors' homes and things like that. And they're used, in a way that is truly mind-boggling. taking whole populations of elderly people and putting them on very powerful antipsychotic drugs, that's a real issue because, you know, these drugs have severe side effects, possibly severe side effects. And, they're certainly safer drugs to be using in elderly people.
Well, let's turn a little bit to the advertising, because I think it was one of my favorite parts of the book spoke about Vince Perry, who's an ad man, and that he has literally sat down with the drug companies to create new diseases or repackage, reemphasize old ones.
Sure, and Vince Perry has lots of company in terms of, you know, people in public relations companies who get hired by manufacturers to say, we need to be able to increase the market for something. We need to get people on board. We have to characterize conditions in a new way. And Vince Perry says the best conditions for reshaping this way are the sort of mental conditions, anxiety and social phobia and things like that. And at least one company was very successful in essentially reshaping what physicians think about social phobia, hence creating the condition social anxiety disorder, and then having the first approved drug to treat it, which was Paxil. When you talk to the PR people point blank, they will tell you this is essentially what we need to do. We need to get coalitions involved. We need to get these third-party agents to be speaking on behalf of the company. We need tapping into the key opinion leaders. So physicians often take their cues from other physicians. And so what you need to do if you're a drug company trying to recharacterize a condition, you just have to get some of the key thought leaders on board. And these companies have lots of money to do that. And so it's really a kind of whole package, both from the specialists, the physicians, and then the patient groups, and so on. And so we've seen this kind of reshaping of conditions in a number of examples. There's those of social anxiety disorder, but there's also we've seen this with osteoporosis. So 15 years ago, osteoporosis. One of the major companies producing the first what we call a bisphosphonate, a drug to treat osteoporosis, did a series of focus groups with women and found something very surprising, and that was women for the most part weren't worried about osteoporosis. And so the company essentially said, well, we need to change that. The only way that we're going to get people into their doctor to get diagnosed and put on these treatments is if we can tell them that they need to be doing this at a younger and younger age. And you might say, well, what's wrong with that? Isn't this kind of a public aren't they doing this in the public interest? Well, the problem is that those drugs are tested in relatively older, relatively unhealthy women, and then are marketed to younger and younger women. In fact, we've seen the advertisements for osteoporosis over the years. The images have really gone from elderly, stooped women to sort of very young, 40-something women who look like breaking a bone is the last thing that should be on their mind. But really, for something that's asymptomatic, which means you don't feel it, and something that's largely due to falls, that is, fractures of the hip and so on. The way that you can drive people into their physician is by using fear, and fear mongering is one of the essential elements of selling sickness. We've seen this with osteoporosis, and now we've seen it also with the cholesterol.
It's interesting, too. I mean, we see it with our politicians. I mean, this is a very, very effective way, hawking fear, selling fear, that it's interesting how it's also being used in our administration currently here in the United States to create behavior that would be subservient and would be kind of make us, toe the line, so to speak.
Yeah. And the problem, of course, is that often you can raise the fear, but people don't know what to do.
Right.
Whereas if you're marketing a drug, you raise the fear and you give the solution, which is go see your doctor, ask them if you're at risk for this, ask for this test, ask for this treatment. So it's really
well. Essentially, it's about people shelling out their money too, and and saying, "Oh, I need this drug. I need this I need this war." You know.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
I mean, it's very effective. It's curious to me. I was thinking about the you had mentioned the public performance syndrome. I was, you know, as benign as being shy was being touted as some disease that one would have to take a drug in order to deal with stage fright. I think that's in the DSM. I think they've actually listed stage fright and shyness as being something that we need to treat.
Right. And there are drugs that can alter your heart rate, and you know, like professional musicians use beta blockers to help calm them when they're under a lot of performance anxiety. You know, that's one thing. It's something completely different to say that if you have a job where you need to speak in public and you get nervous doing that, that then you must have a serotonin disorder, and therefore you need to take this antidepressant, which I think is totally bizarre, but you know, considering the size of the market for those drugs, they're certainly being used by a lot of people.
Well, as a lecturer, I've learned that you're supposed to actually use that fear as a way to do a better program and so forth, or to do a better lecture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are ways around that one, certainly, and
that's part of the
idea.
The other thing I was going to say is that it's not abnormal to be fearful in speaking in public. In fact, you know, when you've looked at surveys of people, you know, some people have said that they'd rather die than speak in public. So public speaking or performing in public is a very, you know, and having anxiety around that is a very natural thing. But if you're going to sell a product, you have to sort of deem it as being something that's abnormal and thus merits treatment.
I wanted to let our listeners know I'm speaking with Alan Castles. He's the author of Selling Sickness, excellent book that talks about the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies turning us all into patients. I was online recently, and I came across a website, Stay Free. I don't know if you're familiar with her publication, Carrie McLaren, I think is her name.
No.
She talked about how Procter & Gamble is currently marketing a tampon for premenstrual girls. And it's called Almost. I mean, I had to think that it had to be a joke, but then she mirrors the potential website that they're going to be promoting this with. And they say that these tampons come in four flavors: Orange County, Blue Note, Red Menace, Green Party, because you're almost there, period.
What do they do?
They're just like preparing the girls for using a tampon. Don't ask me. I mean, to me, it really kind of fit in with the idea that there is nothing to be treated, but it's a marketing ploy for the anxiety that maybe a young girl is going through because she hasn't started her period yet.
Right.
And so she is concerned, but she can still buy something and have a tampon, you know, so she can be prepared for that day when she becomes has
you know,
a period.
That makes me think of a recently approved drug for it's a birth control pill called Seasonal, and this one reduces the number of annual periods that a woman would have from 13 down to 4.
I know a drug pusher who I walk my dog with every day. He's that's a harsh way to say it, but he actually is that's his drug, is Seasonal.
Yeah.
It's popular here in the United States already. I don't know. It's not made it to Canada yet.
Oh, well, I guess it has, but like I say, we don't have the as much of the in-your-face marketing as you have in the U.S. So, you know, this is another thing, is that having 13 periods a year is a normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
Having 4 seems perhaps more convenient and that kind of thing. But, I guess to sell that, you have to sort of characterize the normal periods as being something that could or should be changed.
And right. It becomes, this is an inconvenient thing we need to...
Yeah.
And the studies, I think, are very minuscule in terms of how they really...
Yeah.
Showing if this is an effective thing. But, of course, it's supposed to only be used for individuals that have really problematic long periods or something like that. Yeah.
Right. You know, I wanted to say something about cholesterol. Do you mind if
No, please.
The reason is the first chapter of our book, Selling Sickness, is about cholesterol. And this chapter we've subtitled is Selling to Everyone. And... You know, we've taken the whole high cholesterol hypothesis and really put it under the microscope and say, you know, what's actually being sold here? Because I know in the U.S. you're surrounded by ads for Lipitor and other cholesterol-lowering drugs. You're being urged to know your numbers. And there's this sort of raising of the anxiety around your cholesterol levels. But what most people don't know or won't hear is that cholesterol is an essential part of your physiology. You know, your body needs cholesterol, and that an elevated cholesterol is not a disease in and of itself. An elevated cholesterol might be a risk factor for a future heart attack or stroke, but the fear-mongering and the sort of the physician enthusiasm for getting people to get their cholesterol tested and get put on cholesterol-lowering drugs really defies rationality. And I think anyone, any of your listeners who are on cholesterol-lowering drugs or are being told that they should take cholesterol-lowering drugs, they really need to take a very close look at what those drugs do. And, you know, as we describe this in our book, the risk factor for a heart attack or stroke, because you've got high cholesterol, might be 3%. So if you have a twin brother that has normal, say if I have a twin brother that has normal cholesterol and I have high cholesterol, my risk factor for a future heart attack or stroke might be about 3% more than his. Can that be lowered? Yes, it can be lowered somewhat with cholesterol-lowering drugs and diet and exercise. You know, the diet and the exercise thing is what you should be doing anyways, regardless of what your cholesterol level is. But most people, when asked, try to estimate what your risk is of having a heart attack or stroke because you've got high cholesterol, they will say in the neighborhood of 40, 50, 60%. They will exaggerate the possibility of having an event, you know, 10, 20, 30 times more than it actually is. So there's a huge amount of belief out there in terms of the confidence in these drugs. Though when you look at the data, you find some very surprising things, such as the benefits of cholesterol-lowering drugs are only in men. So women who are being prescribed cholesterol-lowering drugs, there's no solid scientific evidence that those drugs will prevent heart attacks and strokes in women. And most people aren't going to know that. And most people won't know that other risk factors, things like what you eat and how much you exercise and that kind of thing, or whether you smoke or not, have a much more important impact on the possibility of you having a heart attack or stroke than your level of cholesterol. So, you know, to sum up, cholesterol is a risk factor for a future disease. It's not a disease in and of itself. And, you know, I would just say that anyone that's either being put on cholesterol-lowering drugs or is being told that they should look at cholesterol-lowering drugs should take a look at our book. The first chapter pretty well covers it all. The other thing that I didn't mention is that who is out there actually defining what is normal in terms of your cholesterol level? And we have found, again, some very shocking things, such as the National Cholesterol Education program in the U.S., this is a group of physicians that sit down and decide at what level people should be treated for high cholesterol. 8 of the 9 committee members receive money from the pharmaceutical industry, have ties, are consultants, or own shares in pharmaceutical companies. This created a mini scandal when this erupted or when this came to light last year by some journalists in the U.S. that, I mean, it seems quite shocking that we would allow a committee that's supposed to advise physicians on how to treat cholesterol, we allow that committee to be basically stacked by pharmaceutical industry people. So that's what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, the connection between many doctors who actually have financial incentive to work with these drug companies, I think, is, you know, makes the cronyism going on in our government look, you know, look about the same. I mean, it's one would think that it would be unethical and would be something that they would not be allowed in some way to
right.
be either on the board, to be a spokesperson. But obviously, they work so closely hand in hand. I mean, the evidence in your book concerning the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, what was really compelling to understand that they are not only paid a lot of money, but they clearly they're hawking a lot of these free sample kind of things. But it's something.
Yeah,
that
and you know, that's not to say that someone in that position can't do a good and honest job of representing the value of drugs, even though they take money from the pharmaceutical industry. So I wouldn't say that you know that anyone who has ties to the industry has automatically been corrupted. But at the same time, these companies are in the business of making money, and that if you have someone who's a spokesperson for your drug or on a committee where the sales of your product are at stake, if they are saying things that are going to negatively adversely affect your shareholders, they're not going to last too long. And there's also the potential problem of the perceived conflict of interest. I mean, I think most people would expect that their physician is making decisions about their drug based on the best evidence. We would also hope that the committees guiding our physicians are also making decisions on the best evidence. But quite sadly, we've seen in a number of cases that they haven't been based on the best evidence. They've been based on expert opinion, and sometimes those experts are paid consultants to companies.
Right. We've certainly seen that with the use of the silicone breast implants again. Many of the studies that were showing that this was an appropriate or a good substance to put into one's body have been funded by the companies that sell the silicone.
Yeah.
So this is certainly not anything new. What's interesting to me, I had a friend, an email. I got this from a blog. She wrote about how various social ills are being approached through the pharmaceutical companies, including the Viagra, you know, and or the HRT, the hormone replacement therapy kind of thing, so that women will remain lubricated throughout life and so forth.
Right.
And that she was wondering. She says, "Well, where is Eli Lilly and GlaxoSmithKline Beecham with their pastel-colored, tastefully shaped pill called Non-Violax or Domestiman, you know, to kind of deal with the, you know, problem." I mean, this is a real social ill, is a violence against other women, violent men. Yeah.
It's funny you should mention that. You know, one of the treatments for, we don't mention this in the book, but one of the things that I don't know if you've seen in the U.S. being marketed to men is this condition called andropause. And andropause is basically the male equivalent of female menopause. So as men age, their testosterone levels drop somewhat, and they get irritable and grouchy, and maybe they're not as good in bed, and they feel tired. And the punchline is see your doctor to see if you have andropause, because if that happens and the doctor diagnoses you with andropause, then you can be put on a testosterone replacement therapy. And you know, as if the world needs more men taking more testosterone. back to your issue of family violence, I'm sure testosterone levels are linked to all kinds of things, such as domestic violence and wars and that kind of thing.
Well, we like to think of it more as a learned behavior, but it's interesting that it's often touted as a biological condition.
Sure.
You know, that it's something that we're going to have to. But it's interesting that we haven't come up with a drug for that. I appreciated in your book the details from Dr. Lenore Tyfer, who has been focused on the female sexual dysfunction. She was quoted as saying, "Sex is like dancing. If you break an ankle while you're dancing, you go to the doctor, but your doctor doesn't take a dance history and wouldn't advise you whether your dancing is normal. Cases of sexual, you know, distress, cultural, their economic, political, the whole history has to be looked at. And if it's a disease with pills to fix it, it shifts the ideas about how to get ready for sex. Your body's not good enough. You aren't good enough, but you plus products, now maybe you're good enough." I thought that was...
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, Lenore Tyfer's really at the cutting edge of of those people in our society who are really sort of saying we have to start winding back this cozy relationship between the definitions of disease and the pharmaceutical industry. She's got a website called FSD Alert. FSD stands for Female Sexual Dysfunction.
And so it's fsdalert.what?
.org. It's actually fsd-alert.org.
Okay, so it's F as in Frank, S as in sex, D as in dog, right?
Yep.
-alert.org. Oh, that sounds great. She does a talk called "Not Tonight, Honey, My Patch Fell Off" or something.
Right, yeah, exactly. And she has some a hilarious approach to looking at female... sexual dysfunction. I use that with inverted commas around dysfunction,
right?
Because from her perspective, sexuality is right, you know, it goes across a huge range, and who can define what is normal? Part of the problem, of course, is that we have cultural definitions based on, you know, programs like Sex and the City and so on what is normal. But, you know, your average 45-year-old woman, working woman, who is also juggling two kids, a career, a husband, and a household, and then decides at the end of the day at 11 o'clock at night that she's not actually that interested in sex and she'd rather sleep, is that abnormal? And, you know, obviously the medicalizers of female sexual dysfunction would say someone like that needs help, needs pharmaceutical help. When, in fact, she may need, other kinds of help. You know, we take what might be seen as a social problem and reconstruct it as a medical problem and then apply drugs to it. That's part of the formula.
And I think this is indicative of the way we deal with health in general, that we often don't look at the complexity of the interactions of both our background, our economic, political, cultural impact that could be causing distress in some level or another, that we tend to run to the pill. And I think that this is very much indicative of a culture that's inundated with advertising, because everything is a quick fix, whether it's an alcohol drink or it's a cigarette.
Yeah.
That we don't feel good, I want to fix it, take the pill.
Right.
You know,
and so we shouldn't really blame the pharmaceutical industry for tapping into this. I mean, this very much fits our quick stop fast food type of lifestyle. However, sometimes the quick fix is more trouble and actually causes more problems. And you know, people need objective and independent sources of information about health and treatments.
Maybe you could let our listeners know about the
Cochrane. You know,
it's called the Cochrane Collaboration.
Yeah, the Cochrane Collaboration has the free abstracts of systematic reviews. That's cochrane.org, Cochrane.org. That's a very good site.
And this site would then what? If people are having a symptom of some sort, they could go there.
It is independent analysis of clinical trials of treatments. So if you're being put on a treatment, you can go there and read, what does the evidence actually say?
I see. So this is a way for, it's a kind of clearinghouse for the drugs that are available out there.
Yeah, not just drugs, but other treatments as well.
Oh, I see. So it does the whole gamut of potential treatments.
And the Cochrane Collaboration is an international group of consumers, of researchers, of scientists, and so on, largely volunteer, that do these kinds of systematic reviews and really provide very valuable information. I'm off next week to Australia to attend their annual conference in Melbourne this year.
Oh, great.
So there's Cochrane. Another group that I like in the U.S., actually, whenever it concerns anything dealing with women's health, is the National Women's Health Network.
Right. I've been in touch with them for maybe 15 years myself.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know what their website is, but if you did a search on National Women's Health Network, they're based in Washington, D.C. They provide, in my estimation, some of the best independent analyses of treatments and such concerning women. They don't take money from the pharmaceutical industry.
They had been putting HRT, hormone replacement therapy, down for years. I mean, they had.
Oh yeah, for sure.
They were one of the first to really.
Well, they were one of the key lobbyists to get a good evaluation of the effectiveness of those drugs. So, we owe a lot to the National Women's Health Network.
Well, so are there other websites that you could recommend, say someone is having a problem or something, some kind of symptom that they would want to find out more information? Can you recommend a medical website that you think would be appropriate?
Yeah, you know, most of the sites that I'm really familiar with have to do with pharmaceuticals. So Public Citizen, U.S. Public Citizen, publishes a book called Worst Pills, Best Pills.
Oh, right,
And they have a website called worstpills.org, and you can sign up there for a subscription and get all kinds of information on a lot of very heavily prescribed drugs. And I think their stuff is very solid and you know, very valuable. I subscribe to worstpills.org because it they have people on staff that. First of all, don't take money from the pharmaceutical industry, but then can give a careful scientific evaluation of a lot of different treatments.
Well, do you have any plans to come to the Bay Area with your book, or are you?
You know, I'd love to.
There's not a lot of probably money to.
Yeah, Ray, the co-author Ray Moynihan. I think he came to Los Angeles back in June. He did a few readings, I believe, yeah, I'd certainly like to. Somebody invites me.
Okay. Well, if for any reason you do come down to the Bay Area, we'd love to continue this conversation. I appreciate your taking the time today. I've been speaking with Alan Cassells, the co-author with Ray Moynihan of Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. I really appreciate your taking the time. Is there any other summary statement or anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just say that that it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, we paint the picture that the pharmaceutical industry is very much in the shadows, creating and promoting diseases. And I think that that's a very defensible hypothesis. At the same time, there are some really good groups out there that are standing up to this. And, you know, Leonora Tyfer's New View Group, the groups like the National Women's Health Network and so on. So there are some groups out there that are really trying to fight the corporate invasion of drugs into our lives. And I think people should, you know, use their sources. They should support those kinds of groups. And, you know, it's all about, at the end of the day, people making appropriate choices about whether or not they need a drug or not.
Well, do you think are there any campaigns to work to get these advertisements taken off the television?
Say that again?
Are there any campaigns that you know of that are addressing the use of pharmaceutical ads on television?
Oh, yeah. You know, in fact, there's been a number of groups in the U.S. that have lobbied vigorously against direct-to-consumer advertising. Unfortunately, other powerful groups have really bought the pharma line, and one noteworthy one being the American Medical Association, at the recent conference, there was a, I think there was a motion that they should not support, I'm not exactly sure how it was worded, something about not supporting direct-to-consumer advertising or banning them, and it got thrown out. So, you know, when the major physicians organization in the U.S. has bought into advertising of drugs, there's something wrong with that picture. I think a lot of very thoughtful physicians hate spending time having to talk people out of drugs they think that the patient thinks they need, and that time could be better spent in other ways. So the fact that the AMA hasn't come out publicly against direct-to-consumer advertising is really quite shocking.
So maybe letters to the AMA would be a good place to start.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate your being on the show today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yes, it has. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
And this is the Feminist Radio Program, brought to you here on Free Radio Santa Cruz every Wednesday from 10 until noon. Stay tuned at noon for Democracy Now! And if you have any comments on this program or the previous one with Greg Palast, please call 427-3772. The lines are open.